Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is music consultant with Little City Sounds and director of the Omni Sound Project, Lisa Mahach. But let's start here. It really looks like songwriters are going to take it on the chin again, even though Spotify is about to raise its prices. The streaming service is about to raise its rates $1 to $2 extra every month, depending on the market. And for that, premium users are going to receive audiobooks along with podcasts and ad-free music. The problem is that this change is going to have a negative effect on mechanical royalty rates paid to songwriters and publishers. Because the paid tier now includes audiobooks along with music streaming, Spotify believes this qualifies for a discount on its U.S. mechanical royalty rate because it's now considered a bundle, and it's now similar to how Amazon bundles Prime and Amazon Music, and Apple bundles Apple Music and Apple News. So now that the paid tier is considered a bundle service with audiobooks, some of the subscription price is now owed to book publishers and authors to license their works as well. Even though this may be fair, it doesn't benefit songwriters and publishers at all. The way that mechanical revenue for bundles is calculated is by seeing what audiobooks are valued as a standalone offering, which is $9.99, and then weighing that against the price of the premium bundle, which is going to be $10.99. This is all according to an agreement between music publishers and streaming services called Phonorecords 4. After all the calculations, music is being valued at 52% of the bundle, or around $5.70 per subscriber. Music publishers have made it clear that they're not going to accept this without a fight, but there's probably little that they can do at the moment. What's really happening here is that Spotify is the one gaining all the benefits, being able to raise prices while justifying the price increase by including audiobooks in the tier. You would think that a much-needed price increase on Spotify would be good for everybody, but not if it's a revenue split. In this case, it looks like both songwriters and audiobook authors are the losers. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. Now, guitar amplifiers go way back to the 40s, and they were used mostly to amplify the sound of the guitar so people in the audience could hear them. It's different now, though, because amplifiers now act more as a personal monitor for the guitar player on stage. But if you're using in-ear monitors, you don't even need that. There are so many good amp simulators now from Fractal, Kemper, Line 6, Neural DSP. There's great modeling amps by Fender and Roland and Boss. And to me, there was a changing of the guard when I saw that Metallica was going out with amp sims instead of the regular amplifier stacks. Yes, it's true, amp sims are now so good that even the hardcore amplifier purists are changing, at least for live. And you can see why. Your favorite tube amp sounds different every night because of venue voltage changes or different temperatures or different miking, the tubes and electronics aging, not to mention the hassle of transporting these heavy boxes with these big transformers that need extra loving during transport. In a business where every pound counts, amp sims just make more sense as long as they can get you in the ballpark sound-wise. But all a guitar player really wants is for the sound to be the same every night with no surprises, and an amp sim is about the only thing that can really guarantee that. I personally think that we've passed the point of no return for guitar amps as we used to know them. Today's players grow up with amp sims and aren't tied to the sounds or the glamour of the vintage tube gear that most everybody over 40 really remembers. Guitar amp heroes like Metallica, Pat Metheny, Dave Mustaine, Steve Vai, John Mayer, Def Leppard, Neil Schon, Joe Satriani, Aerosmith, Don Felder, Mick Jones, Robert Fripp, Tommy Shaw, and literally hundreds more can't all be wrong. My guest this week is Lisa Mahach, who's a music consultant with Little City Sounds and director of the Omni Sound Project, which is an inclusive community for women and marginalized genders in audio engineering. Lisa's writing has been featured in Tape Op magazine as well as a popular Substack newsletter. She's also the creator and host of the Reference Tracks podcast, which features producers and engineers discussing the songs that shape their careers. Lisa coaches independent musicians who are looking to grow their audiences and promote their music. She adds 20 years of community building and marketing experience to a natural enthusiasm for mentoring others. Lisa and I spoke about how the Omni Sound Project began, how there are now more women audio engineers than generally realized, the vibrancy of the Austin music scene, artists not knowing what to do with their projects, and so much more. I spoke with Lisa via Zoom from her studio in Austin. Tell me how you got into the music business.
Yeah. Okay. So through playing music, probably like most of us do. When I was younger, I played guitar, and then I was in a band for about 15 years in Austin, and did that for a long time until the pandemic started. And then during the pandemic, getting a little older, thinking about how I want to be in the music industry without gigging all the time, decided to head into audio and music coaching. So that's what I do now.
Okay, let's talk about that for a little bit then. So now you're doing quite a variety of things. When I looked on your website, there was, marketing and booking and recording and pre-production and release planning. That's quite a lot.
That's through the coaching that I provide to independent musicians who are working on those projects. So my background's in event planning and project management. And so basically what I do is I tell a musician, hey, if you have a project that you're working on, whether it's marketing, whether it's releasing an album, whether it's going on tour, I can help you plan that project. So that's what that refers to on the website. But initially it was through audio engineering that I got into the music world because I had recorded an album on my own and really enjoyed it. And then when I was living in San Francisco, took some classes from Women's Audio Mission there.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I got back to Austin, I really wanted to launch something similar and started planning that out. And then we had 4 in-person classes and then the pandemic started. And so we immediately started presenting classes online. And because everyone was home, we blew up and grew really fast. And so that's been the focus for 4 years. But during that time, people would reach out and just ask questions about business, right? Not so much the audio engineering, but like, how do you do a mailing list and how do you handle a timeline for a project? And so that's how I started the consulting side.
Tell me about event planning, because it seems like that could be one of the most nerve-wracking jobs available.
It really is. And I can't say that I'm terribly well suited to some of the aspects of event planning because I am such a planner and I like for things to go exactly as planned. And that's just not the way live events work. So I like the logistics and the operations and the things in the background. But I got into it through hospitality. You know, I went to college, but I just always loved being in restaurants and working in restaurants. So I got a degree in tourism and then went straight back into restaurants. And so through that, just gradually grew into that role in a lot of restaurants, planning events, had my own place, planned a lot of my own events, and then started working for bigger companies in Austin. But yeah, I really liked being on like the venue side where I kind of knew it was a controlled environment rather than being on the side where you walk into a venue and you don't really know exactly what to expect. So kind of learned where I fit best in that world.
I was a program director for several conferences, and that was crazy because that's pretty much the same thing. I mean, there was always an event planner that did the minutia, but there was still like tons of stuff to do. And, you know, we'd have meetings that online meetings or there'd be 35 people on, you know?
Yeah. And then sometimes a speaker drops out or the catering doesn't show up on time or whatever, and you have to adapt really quickly. And that's incidentally why I'm not an audio engineer either, because that's a skill that audio engineers have to have as well. Adaptability.
Yeah. But I think just from talking to you for a couple of minutes, I think you have the most important skill, which is people skills and a good personality.
Thank you.
Because that means more than anything. If you can't get along with people, then your talent doesn't matter so much.
That's so true, especially in anything customer service related, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so tell me then about your business. And I mean, there's so much that you do. But one of the things I'm curious about is when you help people with branding. And why I bring that up is because when you talk to musicians about branding, their eyes glaze over.
They hate it. They hate it so much. It's very much like a anathema to the creative to think about selling something. But you know, I have people come to me and they say they want to be a full-time musician and they want to make money off of their music. Well, you're a small business owner and you have a product that you have to sell. And if you don't want to sell your product, then go get a job and play music on the weekends with your friends. But if you want to make a music career, you do have to sell a service or a product. And that to do that, you do need to get good at branding. So I try so hard though. Like I try to spin it like it's a creative process, you know, because they just can't. I mean, and I'm the same way. It's just tasteful to think about having to brand yourself.
I have this conversation with a fair amount of people that are doing the same thing. You know, I think there's a general consensus. It's like pulling teeth.
It is. It really is. It's been interesting because a lot of times with the goal setting work that I do with my clients, after a few months, they come back and they say, actually, that isn't my goal. I don't like doing what I have to do to reach that goal. And I realized that my goal is different. And that's really valuable to have something that you said you want to do for 10 years, but you never really got around to doing it. And then realize that the reason you never really got around to doing it is because it's not what you actually wanted to do.
Yeah.
So that happens a lot.
I have a good friend who's a great songwriter, and she wanted to expand her horizons, socially especially. So I steered her to someone who helps with that. And when she found out exactly what she had to do or what was expected of her, she came back. She said, I just don't want to do any of that. I'm happy not being, I mean, she's online and she's doing social, but she didn't want to approach it as a business, which, you know, you pretty much have to.
A lot of people are waiting for someone else to come in and do it for them. And that's just not how it works, you know?
Well, there are some agencies that will do that, but it's...
Eventually, yeah. But not just like, I'm brand new, come get me.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Unless you're extraordinarily lucky or talented.
Or have deep pockets.
That's true. Very much. Yeah.
Let's talk about how AI plays into this. And I bring it up because there's a lot of things that AI can help with in terms of promotion, in terms of, it can't help with booking, but I just saw something the other day that there's an online AI manager will do management tech tasks for you. So how do you feel about that?
Well, this answer might change with time, but right now I don't feel threatened by it because I think what you said earlier about this being a people business and relying on people's skills is still applicable. Maybe that won't be the case, or maybe the robots will get more charming. But right now, you can really tell an email that's been written by AI. Or just today, I'm on Substack and I got a Substack from a writer I really like, and he introduced a guest writer. And the guest writer, it was like so clear that she had used AI to write the article. And we all fall prey to that. I did it at the beginning. I would write my blog posts using ChatGPT. And then I finally figured out to use it to create the outlines. And so I harness it that way. And then I'll say, write an introduction paragraph to this topic. And then I'll have it kind of rewrite it a couple times. And then I'll tweak it in my own language. It isn't necessarily faster, but it's so helpful in kind of sustaining that creative energy. When you're doing a lot of content like that, it's exhausting to have to come up with ideas. So I think that's how ChatGPT can really come in handy.
I wrote a book on AI for music production. Came out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you think.
Yeah. I went through about 200 different AIs. Some were in music, just music generation. Some were in production. Some were audio only, and, you know, graphics and you name it. But I got very, very familiar with a lot of them. And as a result, I tried them all myself, and I tried them on things that I was doing. And I have to say, I wound up going back to what I was doing when it comes to like writing blog posts and stuff like that. I went back to doing it the way I always did it, because ultimately it was faster for me. Now, as you say, sometimes you need an idea and certainly will come up with it, things that you hadn't thought of. But boy, you know, I I want it to be faster and it's not.
Yeah. And I've found sometimes where I get frustrated, I'm trying so hard to clarify what I mean to the robot that then I'm like, well, I just wrote what I meant. Just yeah. Go, stop being lazy. Just go write it down.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. What is Omni Sound Projects? What is that?
That's the audio engineering community. It started off as audio engineering and mixing classes. And then people just started probably around, I'd say, March of last year, 2023, we started seeing a really steep decline in online attendance. And I checked in with the other organizations like ours, and we were all experiencing it. And so I took a couple months to kind of figure out what was next. YouTube channel, podcast, things like that, and really settled on a Substack, which is a newsletter, kind of like a combination of a newsletter and a blog. That's been going really well. It turns out that people are really enjoying learning that way. We're still providing educational content. We're still focusing on marginalized people within audio engineering, women and gender minorities. And we have found huge like engagement with Substack. We're the biggest audio engineering newsletter on the platform. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow. This is only for women?
No, it's for everybody.
Oh.
But the focus is on inclusion and diversity and just making sure that people are all feeling included, which many, many men are up for that task. So we're happy to have them.
One of the things I noticed, I'm obviously older than you. And when I started, there were very few women in audio. And the ones that were there didn't do themselves any favors because they overcompensated. And I've found that that's not the case anymore, that women in general, and I'm just talking about the audio business, engineering and production and everything, are much more self-confident and don't feel they have to do that anymore, at least in my experience. What have you noticed?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely, I was born in the 70s, so I'm older, a little older. And so when I was getting interested in it, I was certainly one of the only women. And that's why I really enjoyed finding Women's Audio Mission and being in a room full of women, because the whole learning environment was completely different. And I got to relax and actually absorb information rather than play defense or try to prove myself or whatever. So I can see what you mean by overcompensating, but I think the environment invited that. You know, there's a lot of gatekeeping and a lot of having to prove yourself. There's a lot of really insulting behavior, not just, you know, unwanted advances or things like that, but just like walking in a room and asking someone to get you coffee, that's the engineer. Things like that happened all the time. And they do still happen, but I think you're right. We're seeing less and less of it because there are just more people, more women coming into the studio. And it's happening quickly. That scales are tipping really fast, which is great.
When did you see that first start happening?
Actually, like maybe 2 years ago. So I think the pandemic actually, you know, social media for all its ills is a really great way to bring communities together that have previously felt isolated. And I think that's what we saw in the pandemic. We had these organizations, I think there were like five of us, and I reached out to the others and I was like, let's all kind of pick a thing to focus on so that we're not overlapping and we're promoting, you know, that we're helping each other. And they were all game for that. And then I could say this year or maybe last year, there's got to be 50 or 60 organizations dedicated to gender minorities in audio engineering and music production. And I think it just hit a groundswell. It just hit that tipping point, right? And so I think we're going to see huge changes in the next decade. One thing I'd love to hear people stop repeating is that only 3% of engineers are women. And that is a statistic that's pulled from award-winning engineers. And so we still have a lot of ways to go to make sure that women are nominated and receiving awards and accolades, because that's, we're there. We're really there, but we're not getting quite the attention. And then that creates that feedback loop of like, well, there's just not that many women to hire or give awards to, so we don't have to do it. We don't have to try to do it. So I want to kind of see that statistic used differently.
I'm not aware of any intentional, when it comes to awards anyway, subjugation of any minorities.
No, I think it's just laziness. I think people just don't seek out. They see their community, their friends, the people that are like them, they choose those people for the nominating committees, and then those people nominate the people like them. So I think you just have to be intentional. You have to sit down and say, if we're having, like, for example, the Austin Music Awards repeatedly every year chooses about 80 to 90% males, and there's no lack of representation of other genders in each of the categories, but their nominating committee are largely guys who are kind of hanging out in the same circles with the same bands, and it's just laziness. It's not intentional. But if you really do care, you do have to set that intention. Okay, we need to have some different people on the nominating committee to start with, so that then we can have broader representation. It's amazing. The second you get one person who's really trying on board, everything changes overnight. You know, we were lucky. I'm a contributor to Tapop magazine, and Larry Crane invited me a few years ago to start bringing more women into the magazine. And the last issue, he had probably half and half, and not only female audio engineers, but female contributors. And it just happened with that intention of inviting people in.
That's awesome. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it
And
was
that's
so
a good
cool.
thing, though, because, I didn't intentionally look to see if it was a man or a woman that wrote the
Right.
article.
Yes, and that's where we want to go. That's where we want to be.
Yeah, I never had any problem myself working with female audio engineers, that I just felt that the ones I work with were a little more focused on
Yeah,
what
well,
needed to be
women are
done.
socialized to have those soft skills. It doesn't mean that men can't develop them, but we're conditioned to have them from an early age. And those soft skills come in real handy in the recording studio. It's such a high-pressure environment. Being creative and being vulnerable in front of other people is so scary. And to have somebody who can navigate those things, pick up on social cues, pick up on someone in the band's not comfortable, but they're not really talking about it. Let's take a break. Those are things that women have been conditioned to be really skilled at. And so I think we do excel in that environment.
Okay, tell me about the Austin music scene.
Yeah.
And the Austin recording scene. Let's talk about music first. So one of the things that we're seeing throughout the industry is there are fewer bands. There are lots of artists, but fewer bands. Is that the same in Austin?
It's hard for me to say because I'm in the country world predominantly, country and Americana and folk. And so that's always been more of a soloist thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a vibrant town. There's 600 bands a night playing. So we certainly have plenty of people that are still in bands and very focused on live music. I can't say that I've really seen a decline in that in Austin anyway.
Is there such a thing as pay to play there?
No. Austin is a very like industry free zone. We have not adopted most of the things that the music industry at large uses for better or worse, sometimes better, but often like we really don't have an industry support for anybody who wants to really do anything other than play live music 5 nights a week. If you want to do that, you tend to in the past leave Austin. And so, you know, we have Nashville, New York, LA, and that's kind of where people go when they're ready to take their career to a different level.
Of course, in LA for years, geez, it must be 25 years we've had pay to play in clubs. And it's subtle. It's like you have to buy 200 tickets, which is the same thing, really. But I have one of my best friends is a bass player, and he plays with a lot of well-known people. And he was doing a gig at a local club with some other rather famous musicians or semi-famous musicians. And he called me up and he says, "This is a new one. They're actually charging for a sound check.
Charging the band.
The band for a sound check. It was $50 if you want to do a sound check."
Well, and now with merch fees, taking a cut of merchandise, I mean, it is crazy. How are people supposed to make a living?
Yeah, it's crazy. And
It's a cooperative experience.
these people could afford it. So they just laughed it off as, "Well, this is just another thing." But, if you can't afford it, and if that's, which most musicians can't when they're starting, it's like, wow, this is
Right.
another level.
Ostensibly, they're supposed to be making money off of the sales to the patrons who come see a band. They don't need to be charging on top of that. It's crazy. We don't have pay to play, but we do see people judged by the same metrics in terms of being asked to come back, you know, depending on their draw. And then we do quite frequently, you have the responsibility to fill an entire bill and ask other bands to play with you. And then your success in that endeavor is what, you know, you're, if you're invited back or not. So it's all about the, you know, getting the people in the venues.
Okay, let's talk about the Austin recording scene. I don't know how much you know about it or how much you're in it, but you are more than I am.
Yes, I know it pretty well.
Okay.
It's very decentralized. So we don't have, again, we don't have that industry where a label is going to send a client to us necessarily. It does happen. There's a couple bigger studios that have that happen. But in general, what we see are mom and pop style, small businesses where the artists are scraping together their own money, not using any kind of advance, and they're coming in without a producer. And so that engineer is often stepping into that role. They're the studio manager, the producer, and the engineer. And so because of that, it does keep us on a more casual level. It's hard to scale when you're in all those roles. But the flip side is we just have some really sweet, amazing studios that put out incredible work and are really welcoming places to be for people. So I think for your first recording experience, it's a very inclusive and open scene. But I do feel for the studio owners because they're really kind of having to lower rates and do things to attract the people that are in Austin that are able to record.
Yeah, I suppose there's a lot of studios, especially mom and pop ones, and that keeps the rates down.
Yeah, yeah. I see people shifting to daily rates. Have you seen that?
It's been daily for a long time here.
Okay. We have, with the overdub studios and things, they still do like hourly, and they were doing that for a while in Austin, but now we're seeing the dailies, which is nice. Takes a little of that pressure off.
Especially the big studios have always done that, but what they'll do is they'll put a time limit on it. So it's 12 hours.
Right.
And you just pay extra if you go over.
Yeah.
But frankly, it depends on your age more than anything. You know, if you're younger, you can go 16-hour days and you know, you're okay with it. But most people I know just work normal hours if they can, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see that too.
Now that you've made the shift, are you still gigging?
No, not at all.
Okay. So you really did make a shift.
100%. Yeah, I've not performed since the pandemic started.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm almost 50, so I feel fine because I'm tired. Yeah. But I do miss specifically, like I always played in a band. I never did any solo work. And so I recorded songs solo, but I never performed solo. And I really missed that. You know, my bandmates and I, they were my two best friends. They are my two best friends. And we would always just have a great time on stage and crack jokes. And we had a really good community that just never missed a show. But even back then, even when we were in our 30s and 40s, we really insisted on the happy hour shows and the opening slots because they would try to give us this 1 a.m.
Yeah, right.
You can't do that. We all had jobs and, you know, they had kids. And so it's never been the best fit for my lifestyle. I guess I could, in my 20s, I could probably handle it. But since then, I'm gigging constantly is not something that I'm able to sustain healthily. But I do. I miss being on stage. You know, I'd like to get back to it at some point. But I just don't know that I see that happening. What about you?
Well, I was a touring guitar player until I was 40. And I was out on a tour with somebody and it was just a terrible tour. And at the end, I decided that was it. I've had it. And I'm just going to go in the studio. And that was one of the best days of my life.
Oh, nice.
And the reason why was you self-identify as a musician and everything revolves around that. At least I did.
Yeah.
And as soon as that was no longer the case, this giant weight just left my shoulders.
That's so good.
You know, it was one of those things when I look back, it's like, oh, that was so great. And it's not that I look back and say, I should have done that sooner because it happened. Timing happens because it happens. It was good. It was a good time for me to just stay in the studio all the time. That had its own set of restrictions, let's say, because now instead of being on the road all the time, now I'm all the time in the studio. That's not good either.
Yeah. And especially now when so much of studio work is solitary and mix engineers, mastering engineers are just staring at a computer screen for hours and hours at a time, can get unhealthy quick.
Well, I have two rules that really help on that. The first rule is I go out for lunch every day. I try to meet somebody, a friend or a client or somebody, and but it just breaks up the day and it gets me out. The second thing is I never take a phone call or a text while I'm eating. That's my time, and yeah, it's not for anybody else. And those two things have helped me quite a bit.
That's awesome. Very smart.
Don't know if it's smart, but it works for me. Okay, so you made the switch. How difficult was that for you?
Well, again, because of the pandemic, it was just, it wasn't my choice. You know, we were gigging right up until, gosh, I think our last gig was in February of 2020. And I was heavily, heavily in the music scene, living with a couple of musicians and constantly going to see their shows. And so I missed it terribly, you know, it was really hard. But Omni Sound Project gave me so much to do, and I was having so much fun with that, and it provided a lot of social connection that I'd been missing. And I guess I just kind of got used to it. Yeah. And now on occasion, I'll think, well, that'd be fun, but it's not a overarching drive like it used to be to perform.
A lot of it has to do with the fact that life is a little bit easier when you don't have to worry about that. That's the other thing.
It is. And it wasn't our full-time thing. We were all working. And like I said, they had children. And so it was a lot of work to get us all together and practice and find gigs if you're not just totally focused on that all the time. So I think it was kind of a pretty graceful transition, actually.
Well, now with your coaching, you seem to do everything word of mouth, right?
Really and truly, more now than ever. I actually just deleted my Instagram like yesterday because it's just me. And I'm spending so much time creating content on several different platforms that I finally just did an audit, like what's actually getting traffic. Podcasts is huge. I have a podcast, and podcasting for others is huge. And then writing the Substack or LinkedIn newsletters, things like that. And so I just cut everything else out. I just decided I just can't do it all. I can't do it all well. And so I'm a little nervous, but honestly, I haven't gotten, as far as I know, I've not gotten any clients from social media. It's all been word of mouth. I offer my clients like referral discounts and stuff, and they've brought everybody. I started with one person and he brought in the second person, and it just grew from there. My max capacity is 20. So my business model isn't, you know, based on, I don't have to have a revolving door of people coming through.
Yeah. And 20 is plenty.
It's a lot. Yeah. Well, we do group coaching. So a lot of times most of those clients are working together in a group, which does help. But yeah, that's a lot of people.
What are the trends that you see in the business?
Oh my gosh. I mean, the number one trend I see is the one that we all see, which is how are we supposed to make money anymore? And that's the one that I think is our biggest call to action right now, is trying to figure out how people can have a sustainable career as a creative person. And that's the one I'm most focused on. And so, you know, positive trends, I see a lot more inclusion and diversity, and I see a lot more access for people who are brand new to put out music on their own or collaborate with people. That's all super exciting. But yeah, the one that I'm really focused on is how are people supposed to make money anymore? The engineers are doing okay because everybody wants to record. But then when they record, that's where people are coming out of a recording session and saying, now what? Now what am I supposed to do? Not realizing that what they were supposed to be doing was work for months prior to recording to make sure that that recording was utilized properly. So I don't know. I'm curious. I mean, I keep turning it back to you, but I am so curious, like what you think of that specific question of how people, because you're in a very different demographic and place and industry. So you're probably still seeing people who are making, you know, sound financial decisions with music or making income. But what do you see with that particular challenge of the money issue, the royalties specifically from streaming?
Well, everybody wants to get into sync. That's one thing. And because everybody wants to get in, it's a lot more difficult. The fact that AI is doing a lot of music that is sufficient for production, so that's a part of it that's going away. I mean, it's actually pretty good at that.
Yeah.
So that's somewhat of a problem. Most of my followers are 40 plus, and they have decided that they've been out of the business and they're getting back in. Some of it is because, well, this is what I always wanted to do, and now I'm getting back to it. Now I can afford it. So there's some of that. And, you know, there's also some of, well, I made money doing this. Maybe now I can make it over here. So they're more concerned. But it's, you know, especially tough. It's one thing when you're 20 years old, it's easy to get a lot of friends to come to a club.
Right.
And when you're 40, it's significantly more difficult for that to happen.
It is. I'm happy to see a focus on like house concerts and listening rooms growing. I think we need to, as 40 plus people, adjust the times of those events.
Yeah, right.
Like the spaces are good. We're getting some nice quiet spaces with comfortable seats, but the shows are still at like 9 or 10 at night. It's like, can I just get like a 4 p.m. concert where I could buy a t-shirt and a record? I'll give you all my money just to come and listen to some peaceful music around 4 o'clock, 4 or 5 o'clock.
That's actually starting out here. And there was a famous actress, and I can't remember who it is, but she started bringing this up saying, I really want to go to early concerts, you know, 5 o'clock or 5:30, it'd be really good. And as a result, there was a venue that started to do that. And I don't know.
Was it Jamie Lee Curtis? Was it?
I think that's who it was. Yes. As a matter of fact.
Somebody like that. Yeah. I saw that same thing and I was like, amen. I'm in the same boat.
No, that being said, I don't know how successful that ended up being.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like my generation, like I feel like boomers and Gen X, like we're not letting go of those things that made us happy as we get older. We still want to go to shows. I still want to go see bands. I still want to buy records and merch of bands I love. I just can't leave the house after 7:30.
Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, it's funny, before you're mentioning about people doing projects and then don't know what to do with it. I can walk to two of the biggest mastering houses in Los Angeles. And they're my friends. So I will frequently go and hang out there. And it always happens where I'll go and one of the engineers will say, you got to listen to this project. And it's so fantastic. And then they tell me, and I asked them what they're going to do with it. And they said, I don't know.
I know. It's the biggest pain point of like what I address. In fact, I'm starting to think of kind of just narrowing my coaching just to that topic completely, just to like a release strategy, because it's time and time again. I've seen it literally countless times. And then it's disappointing. I mean, thank goodness the days of where you pressed a bunch of records or tapes or CDs in there in your closet, thank goodness that's not necessary anymore. But still that same energy of like putting all this effort into the creative process, but nothing into the promotion of it. It's a problem.
And, you know, the bigger problem with that is you have to think about it way in advance. So once the project is finished, it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We talk about this all the time. Though I do think that's changing too, with just with the advent of sync and playlist discoveries of different eras. I don't think it's as important to promote something like right when it comes out. You know, look at what happened with like Kate Bush or Tracy Chapman, people rediscovering music. So I think, you know, there's always hope. You know, don't give up hope if you're listening and you've recorded something that you didn't promote yet. You can do it. But it does take intention. It takes just as much creativity and intention as it does to record the album.
In a few weeks on my podcast, I'm going to have a music attorney. He has a side gig as an artist under a different name. And he's actually done really well with it.
So, well, I'm sure he knows the hardest part of the industry.
Yeah. I'm interested to talk to him to find out what the deal is.
I will for sure be tuning into that one.
Yeah. Trevor McShane is his artist name. Okay. Last question, Lisa. And thanks so much for your time. This is great. It's very, very cool.
I know. It's really, honestly, it's an honor to talk to you. I'm a big fan of your podcast and admire what you've done in your career. So thanks for having me on.
What's the best piece of advice that you've either learned yourself along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Yeah, well, in terms of creative, you know, advice for the creative, I think the number one advice is to make sure your basic needs are met before you're trying to be creative. So instead of thinking, I want to be full-time, get a nice, comfortable place to live that's safe and secure. Make sure that you have everything you need to keep your body nourished and your mind healthy. and then create. I see so many people operating from this state of chaos where they're moving around all the time and having to find a place to live. And I mean, I did that too, for sure. And so I think just getting those basic needs, taking control of, get a little job, you know, get a job that lets you go on tour for, you can go nowadays, you can go on a 3 or 4 day tour. You don't have to go on a multiple month tour, just fly somewhere. My band used to do that. We would go on a vacation. We'd be like, let's go to Portland and tour for 5 nights, you know? And so I think just I've seen over the years and at my age, I've seen the people that are my peers in the Austin music scene that are really thriving and having a healthy relationship with music. They had those basic needs met. They're not still out there trying to figure out where they're going to move or what they're going to eat or how they're going to pay the parking ticket, things like that. So I think that's my number one advice.
Is there a number two?
Was that boring?
No. I mean, you said that was my number one.
Oh yeah, number one. Well, I have lots of advice. I'm frequently criticized for giving tons and tons of unsolicited advice. A behavior that I see being really successful are people who create scenes, right? So people who really bring people in and create communities, and then that community grows together and everyone's having fun doing it. So with some more unsolicited advice.
You can find out more about Lisa at littlecitysounds.com. That's littlecitysounds, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.